Hello, this is Futurist Gerd Leonhard in Zurich, Switzerland. I'm the author of Technology versus Humanity, techversushuman.com, and futuristgerd.com. And today we're having a conversation about my book, Technology versus Humanity, Chapter 6. And the book was written in 2016, but it's becoming very, very current. And right now it's available in 10 different languages, and it's gathering steam, actually, as it ages like a nice whiskey, you could say. So Chapter 6 is Magic to Manic to Toxic. And with me is Peter Van, who is a content curator for the Futures Agency and who has been troubling with reading the book at great detail. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Gert. Good morning. This is a quite a juicy chapter. There's a lot in here. It almost opens with a sentence that reminds me on where we are coming from. Somewhere it says, when Google first launched in 1989, that's 20 years ago. And then you develop this story on how we went from magic to manic to toxic. Mm-hmm. And in the first phase, the magic phase, you mentioned that we see magic moments everywhere now. So can you give some examples of these magic moments? What do you mean by that?
Well, I often like to quote Steve Jobs, rest in peace, on this magic thing, right? Because basically when he spoke, every second sentence was about magic this, magic that, right? Mm-hmm. At the Apple events where he spoke at. And in fact, it was magic, you know, because the iPhone was kind of like a magical device, right? Or is still a magical device. And it changed the world for like music business, for example, like Spotify and apps. And right, so that was magic, and there wasn't really much bad about it. But when we got deep into it, you know, we realized that the magic, too much magic, becomes obsessive, right? Mm-hmm. And then from the obsessive, it's a very short step towards becoming like a poison, because all of a sudden this has become the center of your life, right? So too much of a good thing. That's kind of the headline for this chapter.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also, what is the big deal over here? Because it's all fine. We have magic everywhere. There's an app for everything. We have magical humans. But we are getting emotionally and intellectually manipulated. And so then you ask the question, what's the big deal? So what's the big deal?
Well, I think the big deal is when magic takes over as the new normal. You know, like in many ways, in everybody's life, you have bad things, you have good things, you have negative things, you have positive things. And it's the mix that makes us experience what we are. Because if everything was fantastic and there was never any hesitation, never any issue, we wouldn't earn the progress that we're making. We would just be kind of coasting along, expecting everything to be completely good, right? Mm-hmm. But we have to overcome obstacles. And it's part of this process, you know, part of the effort. I think this is also a human component, that we have to make an effort, right? And when we make the effort, something happens, and all of a sudden we're engaged and we change something and we feel rewarded. And a lot of the magic that we have in technology now removes the effort.
It's like the Google video that we saw some time ago, like this commercial about Google Assistant. Doing everything for you.
I mean, I feel like sometimes when I look at technology, like this sort of digital assistants and stuff, where I'm saying, like, you know, can you just make a goddamn effort to do something yourself, to do something that actually comes from you, rather than being outsourced or delegated or abdicated, as we say, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the hard part about the magic. And if you are, it's like when you go to the circus or a movie, you know, you can go inside the magic, and you get completely trapped in it, and it's fine, right? And you leave again. But when you're inside of technology magic, like augmented reality, virtual reality, HoloLens, you know, the chances of getting inside so far that you don't want to live without it, is not the kind of magic that we need.
There's a lot about that in this chapter about dependence from this technology. And you also mentioned in that context, I mean, you make a comparison, like, it's not yet the dependence like dependence on oxygen, but once it would become something close to that, that's a line we could not cross, or you should not cross, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that humans are the magic. You know, we are, you know, without overstating too much, you know, how great we are. We obviously are not just great, but I think that what is inside of us, possible with us, is the magic, and the technology brings that out or helps us discover it. But then we get confused and we think, oh, this device is the magic. I'm just the person consuming the magic, you know, and that's. That becomes very tempting the more of it you have. And I think that is something we have to consider. How far do we want to go with this, and how much will it substitute for our own magic that we can do?
There is a danger that we flip into even the evil side of things. I mean, you mentioned we may need a couple of digital Hiroshimas to really become aware on how much we have.
Further to the question you just said before, the thing is, you know, when is it too much magic? And I think it's clearly like, if I get up in the morning and I'm going to go about what I want to do, if I need to connect to a virtual network so I can boot up myself, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the end of us. I mean, now I'm getting up and I have a cup of tea or something. I take a shower. You know, I may check my emails there or may not, you know, but I can perfectly live fine without connectivity there, right? But the moment I get up and I have to put on this interface so I can experience the magic of technology, you know, it's like it's no longer optional. And if it's no longer optional, then I would say, well, what have we become? You know, that's toxic because it keeps us in dependency. If the system is down, then we are down, and we're utterly useless humans then at that point, right?
It has to do, I believe, with the distinction between tool and ourselves. That distinction is on the risk of disappearing or vanishing.
Yeah, and I think that's a fluid interface. And in some ways, of course, you would argue that if you're handicapped or dying or you have a really bad disease, you know, then having this kind of magic is good because you come back to life, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I would say if you're healthy, why would you use the magic to become, you know, godly in the parentheses? Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you would no longer be yourself. And this is a really big question. At what point does technology become toxic? And so I always say a little bit of manic, everybody understands. That's like alcohol, drugs, cigarettes. Yeah, we understand how that works. And we can sometimes laugh about it and sometimes we're a victim of it, you know. But it's not so existential. But having too many toxic things poisons the system, right? And when we have toxic things like Facebook, that's a really great example again, is, you know, how Facebook has become a toxin, poisoning our democracy, our truth, and distorting the world and basically just making a ton of money from it, right?
Well, it's obviously not Mark Zuckerberg who's doing that. It's his tool that is doing that.
It's his tool, but it's I think it's the embodiment of the worldview also.
Of course.
You know, I mean, yesterday I read the thing that Mark said about Facebook becoming personal again. And going away from the marketplace to the living room, which I think by that he means he's going to start another version of Facebook, mm-hmm. is what I read between the lines there, which I think I have to admire his guts, you know. But the bottom line is the tool he has built is making everybody damn rich because it substitutes my own efforts with other people's efforts with an algorithm.
Right? It's addictive on both sides. So not only on the user side, but they also have to continue finding new sources of data to be able to sustain their advertising model.
Yeah, and they want to go deeper and deeper and deeper until they can make a digital copy of you. Right? Mm-hmm. And this is not just Facebook. This is general technology problem. I think our problem is that when we go too far with it, then it becomes first manic and then becomes a poison. So human resource analytics, my favorite pet. Yeah. Topic, right?
What is it?
Human resource analytics, the idea of saying that you're going to monitor people at work. Many large companies do this. How many times are you posting on LinkedIn? What time do you open your email? How quick is your response time? How many sales have you done? It's all the metrics of functioning, right? Mm-hmm. In companies is now monitored. And then you get a spreadsheet saying that this person is like, you know, like Open Sesame in China, you know, the credit thing. This person gets 540 points from 600.
So you get a corporate credit.
So. Yeah, so he must be valuable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing you can ever think about.
From an efficiency point of view, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, really. But does it measure things that can't be measured? Why? How would it do that? Mm-hmm. You know, I if I meet an employee, I can tell you in 4 seconds if that person is valuable or not, mm-hmm. by having that kind of conversation and all the stuff that's not, you know, that's called tacit information, right? Mm-hmm. So that is making our environment toxic because we always believe technology knows things better than we do. Mm-hmm. And that's been the problem since the first rise of the personal computer and the internet. You know, we go online, we're like, okay, Wikipedia knows this, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is, you know, I was banned on Wikipedia for 8 years until recently.
Really?
You know? And you know why? No. My entry on Wikipedia was struck down because it said I was insignificant to be on Wikipedia. And the background is some of the editors were from the music business. And they hated my work on Music Like Water, mm-hmm. and on copyright and stuff. And they wanted me to be gone, right? So, I mean, every damn traffic sign is on Wikipedia, right? It's like, you know, and that is the truth. Come on, you know, that's mm-hmm. Okay. So I think that to me is a typical example of when we get too far, there's a toxic effect and then it poisons our body, our brain in many different ways. And a little bit of poison, again, like cigarettes or so, I understand we can survive, you know? But too much poison will kill us, will kill our society, will kill our and this is what we need to be careful of.
Yeah, I don't recall that you used the word poison in this chapter of your book.
No.
But there is a dimension that you have not yet clarified in this call. It's not only toxic, but you also mention human de-skilling mm-hmm. and emotional detachment. Mm-hmm. And why that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, the de-skilling is the deauthorization of ourselves. So use it or lose it, right? That goes for your body, for your fitness, for your brain. The brain is plastic, as we know. Mm-hmm. The brain is capable of changing any time. I mean, at least almost to the very end, right? So if I stop using my brain because I'm saying, well, you know, why? Do I need to know an answer for this? No, I just let the assistant decide, right? Do I need to know how to negotiate a date, you know, with my partner, or how to, you know, find out more, or how to get to the finish line? You know? Mm-hmm. No, I don't need to know that because I just swipe, right? Yeah. And that's the same kind of de-skilling that we have, for example, with pilots, you know, who are now in the danger of de-skilling themselves because it's an automated situation, the glass cockpit syndrome, it's called, right? Mm-hmm. To where in America, at least, because in America, people, it's longer distances than Europe, so there's less to do. Turns out the pilot is only flying 3 minutes out of the average flight.
A takeoff and landing.
Yeah.
And even then,
that can be done by a machine. So, mm-hmm. so it's a de-skilling that goes on, and which is a huge problem for the pilots, of course, because how are you going to jump to a really fast conclusion in 0.4 seconds when you've been de-skilled and just watching the screens the whole time, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem really with the pilots because you'll always have the pilot regardless of the de-skilling because he will not be left out of the cockpit, you know, just for other reasons. But for ourselves, if we de-skill ourselves too much, like forgetting how to use maps, forgetting how to use our own navigation, forgetting how to use our own judgment, forgetting how to retrieve information, how to judge information, how to relate to others. And then we say, okay, yeah, my friends, you know, that's Facebook and LinkedIn. And my decisions on health, that'll be the IBM Health Cloud. Yeah? And do we ask questions? Do we use our own brain? You know, I think less and less. We, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we can just switch it off and just exist in a happy bliss of sovereignty.
Yeah. And so, but other people say, and I'm losing my headphone, other people are saying you will have to cut this.
Keep talking. It's fine.
Yeah.
I can keep up with my monologue too. I'm very good at that.
Yeah. So I'm back. Other people are saying, well, all these new apps and possibilities and conveniences, they all lead to abundance. Like Peter Diamandis is saying, we are living in a world of abundance. But in your book, in this chapter, you are writing, abundance will eventually cause the collapse of capitalism. That's quite a statement.
Yeah, that's true. But the other part of that coin is also where I think I say in the same chapter, it's abundance on the outside and scarcity on the inside. Right?
You have to explain that for me.
That's what technology does. It creates abundance on the outside. I have an unlimited number of songs or movies I can watch or books I can read. Mm-hmm. I can fly to any place in the world for less money than 10 years ago. That's abundant on the outside. But inside, you know, with my connectivity to others, happiness, that is the antidote, essentially, of social networks. that is shrinking because I'm so busy on the outside. Yeah? So contemplation, for example, or boredom, which leads to contemplation and change, is going away because I have this abundance of stuff coming in. Right? So that's why I sometimes use abundance on the outside, scarcity on the inside. And we cannot always just invest in abundance, because what are we creating inside, right? Are we creating relationships? Are we creating happiness? And can you create happiness? You can't. No, you can only foster it, right?
Yeah. But when you use the word happiness, you are talking about like the old Greeks, like Aristotle's Eudaimonian sense of happiness, right?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I mean, there's hedonism and then there's eudaimonia in the Greek literature. But, yeah. You know, this technology is very good at giving us a sort of hedonic happiness. And that's good. You know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I mean, I'd love to get good advice from TripAdvisor or so. That's good. But will it give me the sense, my purpose of life? It can't do that because this is a tool. I'm not going to look to the hammer and say, "Oh, dear hammer, you know, you're like you're my purpose, right?" I use the hammer, right? So I have a mission that I want to achieve inside of myself, and that is basically what I use the tools for. So hence, the new version of this same thing is, you know, technology is not what we seek, but how we seek.
Right? Yeah. Or it could be, you are not a hammer.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to become a hammer of a big tech company or some sort of algorithm that monitors my insurance or something. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So back to your question about capitalism. Really what's happening is that, of course, everybody is aware that technology is creating a scenario where things are becoming cheaper, faster, virtual, automatic, which means the price goes down. Mm-hmm. That's already true for many things. It's not true for medical, or it's not true for money quite yet. And banking, but that is the next step. And energy, of course, right? Energy will become abundant because, you know, we have unlimited supply with nature providing energy. We just have to figure out how to harness it, and we're getting there. So basically, as Diamandis also says, you know, abundance leads to a point to where consumerism is a crazy idea.
Which is the basis of capitalism.
And this kind of scarcity of things is the basis of competing to buy it. And we're going to be in a place in roughly 20 years and maybe 25 years in some instances to where that is abundantly available. The only thing that we need to make sure that is that the price is low enough that everybody, it's available to everybody, which is a huge political challenge. And that's also anti-capitalist in the sense of, if we wanted genetic engineering to be available to everyone, we couldn't sell it for $1 million each. And that is basically another expression that you know from socialist regimes, you know, to where that becomes public, right? And so what I call it, it's creating a sort of post-capitalism.
The abundance, if I can use that word in the following context, the abundance is not only for the goods and the services and so on, but it's also for unintended consequences or intended consequences like tracking and surveillance. So it looks like we also have a democratization of surveillance. Not only governments and institutions are surveilling us, and corporations, but people are, it's P2P, almost surveillance. And that comes with a lot of risks. And you mentioned some of those risks in your book for surveillance in general. There's, by the way, a word that you used from, I think it was from Douglas Rushkoff, digiphrenia, which was one of the risks you had in your book, security, exponential surveillance, increased human de-skilling, building relationships with screens and manipulation at unimaginable scale were the risks you had in your book. Mm-hmm. You may want to elaborate on one or two of them.
Yeah, I think that basically as we reach abundance, of course, we're reaching it by having data about everything. And that makes it possible to be more efficient. So the benefits of the smart city are clear, but at the same time, the unbenefits, the tracking, the observing, the sort of, the magnifying effect, you know, and this way of observing everything, that's the other side of it. So that's kind of where we have to say, sometimes maybe we want the inconvenience of not having the information, and we have to decide on where that would be and how exactly that would work. And for example, if I put my information into the health cloud, would I trust Apple to run the health cloud and to keep it safe and to not give it to others? Well, I would probably trust them a lot more than pretty much anyone else, because I'm an Apple user and I like the Apple philosophy and stuff. But I would want them to be supervised by a neutral entity. Yeah. And that can only be governments. So this kind of surveillance capitalism, as people have called it, right, is kind of an aberration of the Silicon Valley worldview, which is that technology is so good that you're willing to do pretty much any barter, any deal to get it. I think we need to pay for things more often and to avoid this problem. And if we were to pay for things more often, then it would be a disadvantage for those that are not able to pay, right? Mm-hmm. So that is kind of a dilemma for me. And I think that for example, the idea of having a paid for Facebook, which I've set forth for a long time, that would absolutely work, especially if you have a sliding scale for developing countries and things like that. Yeah. Maybe that's what Mark will set out to do. But, you know, to pay, I mean, the average value of a Facebook user is $42 a year. That's what we'd have to pay. So this is basically, sometimes we have to pay to avoid the surveillance. Sometimes we have to have government set standards that would prevent the surveillance. But clearly we're moving into a society where surveillance is the number one business model.
Yeah. Do you think that the governments are the right place to oversee this, to regulate this? Wouldn't a combination of government, academics, institutions be a better fit? I mean, I'm not sure I would trust my government to deal with this reasons.
Yeah, I mean, governments can turn bad also.
Right.
As we've seen in certain countries. But I think ultimately this is like, you know, okay, we have global agreements like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaties. And they set out what the ground rules are. And if you don't abide by the ground rules, you get economic sanctions and you get whacked, right? Mm-hmm. And it kind of works. It's difficult, but it works, you know. And we're going to need that for a lot of those basic civil rights and digital rights that I've set forth in the book as well, like the right to disconnect. Mm-hmm. Right? Do I have the right to exist just as a human? With connecting to myself, so to speak, and connecting to others, do I have the right to insist that that is enough? I think I should have that right. Mm-hmm. I should also have the right to connect at the same time. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's also very important, but I should have the right to exist just by myself. And I think that part of this thing I talk about in this chapter, you know, this idea is this magic explosion happens. You know, we're getting into a whole bunch of good things and a whole bunch of bad things. You know, as I quote Marshall McLuhan, first we build the tools, then the tools build us. Mm-hmm. And Facebook is a great example how this tool has built us.
Mm-hmm. In the book that was published in 2016, you said at that moment, 2016, on a 100-point scale of what could be digitized, we are only at 5. Mm-hmm. And we already Where are we today? Still 5, or is it 10 or 15?
You know, I think we're still between 5 and 10 because, you know, there's still lots. I mean, we don't have 5G. We don't have quantum computing. We don't have substitutes for the electronic materials of mobile phones. Nanotechnology, that doesn't really exist yet. We have to use the cobalt or whatever is in there, right? There's so many limits to how we can roll with technology, including battery. But, you know, imagine battery technology solved 6 weeks of standby time, mobile time on a device, right? Mm-hmm. That's very soon. Imagine quantum technology in the cloud. I can do my DNA in 4 seconds. 5G, you know, 10 gig downloads or so, you know, at pretty much any point, 90% of people on the internet. So we're still at, let's say, 7 now. Going to 100 would be a completely automated virtual reality, a sort of Minority Report type world. Download your brain and upload your brain, right?
Yeah, I'm asking the question because last week or 2 weeks ago, we saw this, to my view, this awesome, very impressive demo of HoloLens 2 at Mobile World Congress. So it's getting very close to being in the virtual world and being in this harness of tools. So these humans that are on stage trying to operate these holograms and these screens that floating around, it's almost like a speaker on a stage that only has a linear way of presenting. You would almost need a canvas. So that's why I'm asking this question on where are we on this 100-point scale? Because I think if we add a little bit of the things that you mentioned before, like quantum computing and better batteries, etc., we are very close to that point.
Yeah, I think the next 10 years will bring all those things become very tangible. The next 5 years for things like AR and mixed reality and virtual reality and HoloLens and holograms and that sort of thing. I think the question that you must ask is, so why are companies like Microsoft and others, why are they inventing and selling this? And the answer is because they can. Right? I mean, it's basically this technology is now feasible at scale. It's becoming doable. It's becoming cheaper. And so if we follow the path of saying we're going to do things because we can, I think I would cut off just about behind the HoloLens here. And I would say the HoloLens is probably useful for doctors, lawyers, and technicians. And on a social level, a personal level, I don't see it. Replacing my brain, basically, by having some sort of supervision, a super visual tool like superhuman, I think could be interesting, but also, of course, gaming and those kind of things. But anyway, I would cut off right there and would say, okay, if we can invent the brain-computer interface, connecting my brain directly to the internet, that's where we would need to cut, right?
Yeah. So it's coming back to your quote that we should not become technology. So if we move beyond the second nature stage, as you call it, which you seem to place at the just after the HoloLens sort of moment?
Well, you know, we have this saying about things where we're saying it's natural, right? It's something we do naturally. Yeah. And that's with a lot of technology is natural from running water to flushing the toilet. It's kind of like, yeah, we don't think about it. But at a certain point when it becomes the new natural, the new default, like I am online as soon as I open my eyes, you know? I'd be extremely worried about what that would create in terms of dependency, and also it would basically dehumanize the things that we need when we wake up, for example, which is to first think about, you know, what we feel and who we are before we start looking at the data flow, you know? I mean, then we're going to end in a world of transcendence, you know? So I think that's that, as I say in the book, you know, it's really important that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, these are very good technologies that we can use for so many things. Yeah. But also we would need rules how to handle the benefits of it. For example, if I'm a doctor operating in virtual reality all day long, would I find the evening terribly boring? You know, could I still talk to my kids without that thing? You know, would I feel like, you know, like you already know, you know, when you're wearing regular glasses, when you take them off, you have a blurred vision. You know, and we kind of say, okay, yeah, I can still go to bed like that, or I can go swimming without the glasses, or, you know, it's okay. But imagine a world to where that you turn from a Tom Cruise type superhuman with a capacity of 1,000x, you take them off, boom, you're back to one, right?
That's a good one. That's something I can explain to my father. So because he's asking me, what are you working on? And I'm trying to explain, but this is a good comparison. If you put off your glasses, you have this blurred vision. If that becomes the state of things with virtual reality, etc., then we have a problem.
Yeah, I think it's like any good thing is too much of a good thing. And so this is the main topic about the magic, manic, toxic chapter. Okay, I want the magic, I don't want the toxic. And somebody has to say, either the provider, the platform, the Consumer Protection Society, the data rights people, the government, the UN, you know, has to say, this is toxic, right? And so therefore, we don't go there. And if you want to be toxic, take a drug, you know, do whatever you need to do to poison yourself, if that's your choice. Right? But then again, we can't make toxic the new normal. That would be like legalizing any drug ever invented just because it seems like good business, you know. and of course, you know, we're adding one drug after the other by legalizing the activities around it. So this is also one of the things where we have to be careful is when we get all the power, what does a social contract do? How do we stick together to make sure that we're still connecting to each other?
You know? So I like that. Don't make toxic the new normal.
Yeah. We'll stop on this, right?
Yes. Good.
So thanks for listening, and you can subscribe to our digital ethics newsletter, which Peter and me are curating together, digitalethics.co, digitalethics.net, some of my blog posts on this, and of course, Digital Ethics on YouTube. I have lots of videos, gertube.com. You get 547 videos, which you can watch on the next summer vacation. And my website is futuristgert, GERT.com. Peter is at Peter Van, V-A-N, on Twitter, right?
That's right.
And of course, you'll find him on the futuresagency.com on the blog and also on co-posting on my blog. So the book is techversushuman.com. It's available in 11 languages. And chapter 3, the mega shifts we talked about a couple of sessions ago, is available for free online for the download, megashifts.digital. And as you can see, I love domains, you know, so I'm going to let a few of them percolate here. I look forward to seeing you down the road. Thanks very much, Peter.
Yes, pleasure being here.
And we're going to reconvene next week to talk about chapter 7. Until we have them all dissected and brought back to life. Thanks very much for tuning in. Bye.